Chapter 34. Miller. The environment suit was better than Miller was used to. He'd only done a couple walks outside during his years on Ceres, and the Star Helix equipment had been old back then. Thick corrugated joints, separable air supply unit, gloves that left his hands 30 degrees colder than the rest of his body. The Rocinante suits were military and recent, no bulkier than standard riot gear, with integrated life support that could probably keep fingers warm after a hand got shot off. Miller floated, one hand on a strap in the airlock, and flexed his fingers, watching the shark skin pattern of the knuckle joints. It didn't feel like enough. "All right, Alex," Holden said. "We're in place. Have the Rossi knock for us." A deep, rumbling vibration shook them. Naomi put a hand against the airlock's curved wall to steady herself. Amos shifted forward to take point, a reactionless automatic rifle in his hands. When he bent his neck, Miller could hear the vertebrae cracking through his radio. It was the only way he could have heard it. They were already in vacuum.
"Okay, Captain," Alex said. "I've got a seal. The standard security override isn't working, so give me a second to..."
"Problem?" Holden said.
"Got it. I've got it. We have a connection," Alex said. Then, a moment later, "It doesn't look like there's much to breathe over there."
"Anything?" Holden asked.
"Nope, hard vacuum," Alex said. "Both her locked doors are open."
"All right, folks," Holden said. "Keep an eye on your air supply. Let's go." Miller took a long breath. The external airlock went from soft red to soft green. Holden slid it open, and Amos launched forward, the captain just behind him. Miller gestured to Naomi with a nod. "Ladies first." The connecting gantry was reinforced, ready to deflect enemy lasers or slow down slugs. Amos landed on the other ship as the hatch to the Rocinante closed behind them. Miller had a moment's vertigo, the ship before them suddenly clicking from ahead to down in his perception, as if they were falling into something. "You all right?" Naomi asked. Miller nodded, and Amos passed into the other ship's hatch. One by one, they went in. The ship was dead. The lights coming off their environment suits played over the soft, almost streamlined curves of the bulkheads, the cushioned walls, the gray suit lockers. One locker was bent out of shape, like someone or something had forced its way out from within. Amos pushed off slow. Under normal circumstances, hard vacuum would have been assurance enough that nothing was about to jump out at them. Right now, Miller figured it was only even money.
"Whole place is shut down," Holden said. "Might be backups in the engine room," Amos said.
"So the ass end of the ship from here," Holden said.
"Pretty much."
"Let's be careful," Holden said.
"I'm heading up to ops," Naomi said.
"If there's anything running off battery, I can..."
"No, you aren't," Holden said.
"We aren't splitting up the group until we know what we're looking at. Stay together." Amos moved down, sinking into the darkness. Holden pushed off after him. Miller followed. He couldn't tell from Naomi's body language whether she was annoyed or relieved. The galley was empty, but signs of struggle showed here and there. A chair with a bent leg. A long, jagged scratch down the wall where something sharp had flaked the paint. Two bullet holes set high along one bulkhead where a shot had gone wide. Miller put a hand out, grabbed one of the tables, and swung slowly.
"Miller?" Holden said. "Are you coming?"
"Look at this," Miller said. The dark spill was the color of amber, flaky and shining like glass in his flashlight beam. Holden hovered closer.
"Zombie vomit?" Holden said.
"Think so."
"Well, I guess we're on the right ship. For some value of right."
The crew quarters hung silent and empty. They went through each of them,
but there were no personal markings, no terminals, no pictures, no clues to the names of the men and women who had lived and breathed and presumably died on the ship. Even the captain's cabin was indicated only by a slightly larger bunk and the face of a locked safe. There was a massive central compartment as high and wide as the hull of the Rosinante. The darkness dominated by 12 huge cylinders encrusted with narrow catwalks and scaffolds. Miller saw Naomi's expression harden.
What are they?
Miller asked.
Torpedo tubes, she said.
Torpedo tubes? He said. Jesus Christ, how many are they packing, 1 million?
12, she said. Just 12.
Capital ship busters, Amos said. Built to pretty much kill whatever you're aiming at with the first shot.
Something like the Doniger? Miller asked. Holden looked back at him, the glow of his heads-up display lighting his features.
Or the Canterbury, he said.
The four of them passed between the wide black tubes in silence. In the machine and fabrication shops, the signs of violence were more pronounced. There was blood on the floor and walls, along with wide swaths of the glassy gold resin that had once been vomit. A uniform lay in a ball. The cloth had been wadded and soaked in something before the cold of space had frozen it. Habits formed from years of walking through crime scenes put a dozen small things in place. The pattern of scratches on the floor and lift doors. The spatter of blood and vomit. The footprints. They all told the story.
They're in engineering, Miller said.
Who? Holden said.
The crew. Whoever was on the ship.
All except that one, he said, gesturing at half a footprint that led toward the lift.
You see how her footprints are over the top of everything else? And there, where she stepped in that blood, it was already dry, flaked instead of smearing.
How do you know it was a girl? Holden asked.
Because it was Julie, Miller said.
Well, whoever's in there, they've been sucking vacuum for a long time, Amos said.
Want to go see?
No one said yes, but they all floated forward. The hatch stood open. If the darkness beyond it seemed more solid, more ominous, more personal than the rest of the dead ship had, it was only Miller's imagination playing tricks. He hesitated, trying to summon up the image of Julie, but she wouldn't come. Floating into the engineering deck was like swimming into a cave. Miller saw the other flashlights playing over walls and panels, looking for live controls, or else controls that could come alive. He aimed his own beam into the body of the room, the dark swallowing it.
We got batteries, Captain, Amos said, and looks like the reactor got shut down. Intentional.
Think you can get it back up?
Want to run some diagnostics, Amos said. There could be a reason they shut it off. And I don't want to find out the hard way.
Good point.
But I can at least get us some... Come on, you bastard.
All around the deck, blue-white lights flared up. The sudden brilliance blinded Miller for a half second. His vision returned with a sense of growing confusion. Naomi gasped, and Holden yelped. Something in the back of Miller's own mind started to shriek, and he forced it into silence. It was just a crime scene. They were only bodies. Except, they weren't. The reactor stood before him, quiescent and dead. All around it, a layer of human flesh. He could pick out arms, hands with fingers splayed so wide they hurt to look at. The long snake of a spine curved, ribs fanning out like the legs of some perverse insect. He tried to make what he was seeing make sense. He'd seen men eviscerated before. He knew that the long, ropey swirl to the left of the thing were intestines. He could see where the small bowel widened to become a colon. The familiar shape of a skull looked out at him. But then, among the familiar anatomy of death and dismemberment, there were other things. Nautilus spirals,
wide swaths of soft black filament, a pale expanse of something that might have been skin cut by a dozen gill-like vents, a half-formed limb that looked equally like an insect and a fetus, without being either one. The frozen, dead flesh surrounded the reactor like the skin of an orange. The crew of the stealth ship. Maybe of the scopuli as well. All but Julie.
Yeah, Amos said. This could take a little longer than I was thinking, Cap.
It's okay, Holden said. His voice on the radio sounded shaky. You don't have to.
It's no trouble. As long as none of that freaky shit broke the containment, reactors should boot up just fine.
You don't mind being around it? Holden said.
Honest, Captain, I'm not thinking about it. Give me 20 minutes. I'll tell you if we got power or if we have to patch a line over from the Rossi.
Okay, Holden said. And then again, his voice more solid.
Okay, but don't touch any of that.
Wasn't going to, Amos said. They floated back out through the hatch, Holden and Naomi and Miller coming last. Is that? Naomi said, then coughed and started again. Is that what's happening on Eros?
Probably, Miller said.
Amos, Holden said, do you have enough battery power to light up the computers?
There was a pause.
Miller took a deep breath, the plastic and ozone scent of the suit's air system filling his nose.
I think so, Amos said dubiously. But if we can get the reactor up first,
bring up the computers.
You're the captain, Captain, Amos said. Have it to you in 5.
In silence, they floated up, back to the airlock, and passed it to the operations deck. Miller hung back, watching the way Holden's trajectory kept him near Naomi and then away from her. Protective and head-shy both, Miller thought. Bad combination. Julie was waiting in the airlock. Not at first, of course. Miller slid back into the space, his mind churning through everything he'd seen just like it was a case. A normal case. His gaze drifted toward the broken locker. There was no suit in it. For a moment, he was back on Eros, in the apartment where Julie had died. There had been an environment suit there. And then Julie was there with him, pushing her way out of the locker.
What were you doing there? He thought.
No brig, he said.
What? Holden said. I just noticed, Miller said. Ship's got no brig. They aren't built to carry prisoners.
Holden made a low, agreeing grunt.
Makes you wonder what they were planning to do with the crew of the scopuli, Naomi said.
The tone of her voice meant she didn't wonder at all.
I don't think they were, Miller said slowly. This whole thing, they were improvising.
Improvising? Naomi said.
Ship was carrying an infectious something or other without enough containment to contain it. Taking on prisoners without a brig to hold them in. They were making this up as they went along.
Or they had to hurry, Holden said. Something happened that made them hurry. But what they did on Eros must have taken months to arrange, maybe years. So maybe something happened at the last minute.
Be interesting to know what, Miller said.
Compared to the rest of the ship, the ops deck looked peaceful, normal. The computers had finished their diagnostics, screens glowing placidly. Naomi went to one, holding the back of the chair with one hand so the gentle touch of her fingers against the screen wouldn't push her backward.
I'll do what I can here, she said. You can check the bridge.
There was a pause that carried weight.
I'll be fine, Naomi said. All right, I know you'll...
Come on, Miller. Miller let the captain float ahead into the bridge. The screens there were spooling through diagnostics so standard Miller recognized them. It was a wider space than he'd imagined, with 5 stations with crash couches customized for other people's bodies.
Holden strapped in at one. Miller took a slow turn around the deck. Nothing seemed out of place here. No blood, no broken chairs or torn padding. When it happened, the fight had been down near the reactor. He wasn't sure yet what that meant. He sat at what, under a standard layout, would have been the security station and opened a private channel to Holden. "Anything you're looking for in particular?" "Briefings, overviews," Holden said shortly. "Whatever's useful. You? See if I can get into the internal monitors. Hoping to find what Julie found," Miller said. The security assumed that anyone sitting at the console had access to the low-level feeds. It still took half an hour to parse the command structure and query interface. Once Miller had that down, it wasn't hard. The timestamp on the log listed the feed as the day the scopuli had gone missing. The security camera in the airlock bay showed the crew, belters most of them, being escorted in. Their captors were in armor, with faceplates lowered. Miller wondered if they'd meant to keep their identities secret. That would almost have suggested they were planning to keep the crew alive. Or maybe they were just wary of some last-minute resistance. The crew of the scopuli weren't wearing environmental suits or armor. A couple of them weren't even wearing uniforms. But Julie was. It was strange, watching her move. With a sense of dislocation, Miller realized that he'd never actually seen her in motion. All the pictures he'd had in his file back on Ceres had been stills. Now, here she was, floating with her chosen compatriots, her hair back out of her eyes, her jaw clamped. She looked very small, surrounded by her crew and the man in armor. The little rich girl who'd turned her back on wealth and status to be with the downtrodden belt. The girl who'd told her mother to sell the Razorback, the ship she'd loved, rather than give in to emotional blackmail. In motion, she looked a little different from the imaginary version he'd built of her. The way she pulled her shoulders back, the habit of reaching her toes toward the floor even in null G. But the basic image was the same. He felt like he was filling in the blanks with the new details, rather than reimagining the woman. The guard said something. The security feed's audio was playing to vacuum, and the scopuli crew looked aghast. Then, hesitantly, the captain started taking his uniform off. They were stripping the prisoners. Miller shook his head. "Bad plan." "What?" Holden said. "Nothing, sorry." Julie wasn't moving. One of the guards moved toward her, his legs braced on the wall. Julie, who'd lived through being raped, maybe, or something as bad. Who'd studied jiu-jitsu to feel safe afterward. Maybe they thought she was just being modest. Maybe they were afraid she was hiding a weapon under her clothes. Either way, they tried to force the point. One of the guards pushed her, and she latched onto his arm like her life depended on it. Miller winced when he saw the man's elbow bend the wrong way, but he also smiled. "That's my girl," he thought. "Give 'em hell." And she did. For almost 40 seconds, the airlock bay was a battleground. Even some of the cowed scopuli crew tried to join in, but then Julie didn't see a thick-shouldered man launch from behind her. Miller felt it when the gauntleted hand hammered Julie's temple. She wasn't out, but she was groggy. The men with guns stripped her with a cold efficiency, and when there were no weapons or comm devices, they handed her a jumpsuit and shoved her in a locker. The others they led down into the ship. Miller matched timestamps and switched feeds. The prisoners were taken to the galley, then bound to the tables. One of the guards spent a minute or so talking, but with his faceplate down. The only clues Miller had to the content of the sermon were the reactions of the crew. Wide-eyed disbelief, confusion, outrage, and fear. The guard could have been saying anything. Miller started skipping. A few hours, then a few more. The ship was under thrust.
the prisoners actually sitting at the tables instead of floating near them. He flipped to other parts of the ship. Julie's locker was still closed. If he hadn't known better, he'd have assumed she was dead. He skipped ahead. 132 hours later, the crew of the Scapulae grew a pair. Miller saw it in their bodies even before the violence started. He'd seen holding cells rise up before, and the prisoners had the same sullen but excited look. The feed showed the stretch of wall where he'd seen the bullet holes. They weren't there yet. They would be. A man came into the picture with a tray of food rations. Here it comes, Miller thought. The fight was short and brutal. The prisoners didn't stand a chance. Miller watched as they hauled one of them, a sandy-haired man, to the airlock and spaced him. The others were put in heavy restraints. Some wept, some screamed. Miller skipped ahead. It had to be in there someplace. The moment when it, whatever it was, got loose. But either it had happened in some unmonitored crew quarters, or it had been there from the beginning. Almost exactly 160 hours after Julie had gone into the locker, a man in a white jumper, eyes glassy and stance unsure, lurched out of the crew quarters and vomited on one of the guards.
Fuck!
Amos shouted. Miller was out of his chair before he knew what had happened. Holden was up too. Amos, Holden said, talk to me.
Hold on, Amos said. Yeah, it's okay, Captain. It's just these fuckers stripped off a bunch of the reactor shielding. We've got her up, but I sucked down a few more rads than I'd have picked.
Get back to the Rossi, Holden said. Miller steadied himself against a wall, pushing back down toward the control stations.
No offense, sir, but it ain't like I'm about to start pissing blood or anything fun like that, Amos said. I got surprised more than anything. I start feeling itchy, I'll head back over. But I can get some atmosphere for us by working out of the machine shop if you give me a few more minutes.
Miller watched Holden's face as the man struggled. He could make it an order. He could leave it be.
Okay, Amos, but you start getting lightheaded or anything, I mean anything, and you get over to the sick bay.
Aye, aye, Amos said.
Alex, keep an eye on Amos's biomed feed from over there. Give us a heads up if you see a problem, Holden said on the general channel.
Roger,
came Alex's lazy drawl.
You find anything?
Holden asked Miller on their private channel.
Nothing unexpected, Miller said. You?
Yeah, actually, take a look. Miller pushed himself to the screen Holden had been working. Holden pulled himself back into the station and started pulling up feeds.
I was thinking that someone had to go last, Holden said. I mean, there had to be someone who was the least sick when whatever it was got loose. So I went through the directory to see what activity was going on before the system went dead.
And?
There's a whole bunch of activity that looks like it happened a couple of days before the system shut down, and then nothing for two solid days. And then, a little spike. A lot of accessed files and system diagnostics. Then someone hacked the override codes to blow atmosphere.
It was Julie, then.
That's what I was thinking, Holden said. But one of the feeds she accessed was... Shit, where is it? It was right... Oh, here. Watch this.
The screen blinked, controls dropping to standby, and a high-res emblem, green and gold, came up. The corporate logo of Protogen, with a slogan Miller hadn't seen before. First, fastest, furthest.
What's the timestamp on the file? Miller asked.
The original was created about 2 years ago, Holden said. This copy was burned 8 months ago. The emblem faded, and a pleasant-faced man sitting at a desk took its place. He had dark hair with just a scattering of gray at the temples, and lips that seemed used to smiling. He nodded at the camera. The smile didn't reach his eyes, which were as empty as a shark's. Sociopath, Miller thought.
The man's lips began moving soundlessly. Holden said, "Shit," and hit a switch to have the audio transmitted to their suits. He rewound the video feed and started it over. "Mr. Dresden," the man said, "I would like to thank you and the members of the board for taking the time to review this information. Your support, both financial and otherwise, has been absolutely essential to the incredible discoveries we've seen on this project. While my team has been point man, as it were, Protogen's tireless commitment to the advancement of science has made our work possible. Gentlemen, I will be frank. The Phoebe protomolecule has exceeded all our expectations. I believe it represents a genuinely game-changing technological breakthrough. I know that these kinds of corporate presentations are prone to hyperbole. Please understand that I have thought about this carefully and chosen my words. Protogen can become the most important and powerful entity in the history of the human race. But it will require initiative, ambition, and bold action."
"He's talking about killing people," Miller said.
"You've seen this already?" Holden said. Miller shook his head. The feed changed. The man faded out, and an animation took his place. A graphic representation of the solar system. Orbits marked in wide swaths of color showed the plane of the elliptic. The virtual camera swirled out from the inner planets where Mr. Dresden and board members presumably were, and out toward the gas giants. "For those of you on the board unfamiliar with the project, 8 years ago the first manned landing was made on Phoebe," the sociopath said. The animation zoomed in toward Saturn, rings and planet flying past in a triumph of graphic design over accuracy. "A small ice moon, the assumption was that Phoebe would eventually be mined for water, much like the rings themselves. The Martian government commissioned a scientific survey more out of a sense of bureaucratic completeness than from expectation of economic gain. Core samples were taken, and when silicate anomalies raised flags, Protogen was approached as co-sponsor of a long-term research facility. The moon itself, Phoebe, filled the frame, turning slowly to show all sides like a prostitute at a cheap brothel. It was a crater-marked lump, indistinguishable from 1,000 other asteroids and planetesimals Miller had seen. Given Phoebe's extra-elliptical orbit, the sociopath went on, one theory has been that it was a body that originated in the Kuiper Belt and had been captured by Saturn when it happened to pass through the solar system. The existence of complex silicon structures within the interior ice, along with suggestions of impact-resistant structures within the architecture of the body itself, have forced us to reevaluate this. Using analyses proprietary to Protogen and not yet shared with the Martian team, we have determined beyond any credible doubt that what you are seeing now is not a naturally formed planetesimal, but a weapon. Specifically, a weapon designed to carry its payload through the depths of interplanetary space and deliver it safely onto Earth 2 1/3 billion years ago, when life itself was in its earliest stages. And the payload, gentlemen, is this." The display clicked to a graphic that Miller couldn't quite parse. It looked like the medical text of a virus, but with wide, looping structures that were at once beautiful and improbable. "The protomolecule first caught our interest for its ability to maintain its primary structure in a wide variety of conditions through secondary and tertiary changes. It also showed an affinity for carbon and silicon structures. Its activity suggested it was not in itself a living thing, but a set of free-floating instructions designed to adapt to and guide other replicating systems. Animal experiments suggest that its effects are not exclusive to simple replicators, but are, in fact, scalable."
"Animal tests," Miller said. "What, they dumped it on a cat?"
"The initial implication of this," the sociopath went on,
is that a larger biosphere exists, of which our solar system is only a part, and that the protomolecule is an artifact of that environment. That alone, I think you must agree, would revolutionize human understanding of the universe. Let me assure you, it's small beer. If accidents of orbital mechanics had not captured Phoebe, life as we know it would not presently exist. But something else would. The earliest cellular life on Earth would have been hijacked, reprogrammed along lines contained within the structure of the protomolecule. The sociopath reappeared. For the first time, smile lines appeared around his eyes, like a parody of themselves. Miller felt a visceral hatred growing in his gut, and knew himself well enough to recognize it for what it was. Fear. Protogen is in a position to take sole possession of not only the first technology of genuinely extraterrestrial origin, but also a prefabricated mechanism for the manipulation of living systems and the first clues as to the nature of the larger, I will call it galactic, biosphere. Directed by human hands, the applications of this are limitless. I believe that the opportunity now facing not only us, but life itself, is as profound and transformative as anything that has ever happened. And, further, the control of this technology will represent the base of all political and economic power from now on. I urge you to consider the technical details I have outlined in the attached. Moving quickly to understand the programming, mechanism, and intent of the protomolecule, as well as its direct application to human beings, will mark the difference between a protogen-led future and being left behind. I urge immediate and decisive action to take exclusive control of the protomolecule and move forward with large-scale testing. Thank you for your time and attention. The sociopath smiled again, and the corporate logo reappeared. First, fastest, furthest. Miller's heart was racing. Okay. All right, he said. And then, fuck me. Protogen, protomolecule, Holden said. They had no idea what it does, but they slapped a label on it like they'd made it. They found an alien weapon, and all they could think to do was brand it. There's reason to think these boys are pretty impressed with themselves, Miller replied with a nod. Now, I'm not a scientist or anything, Holden said, but it seems to me like taking an alien supervirus and dropping it into a space station would be a bad idea. It's been 2 years, Miller said. They've been doing tests. They've been... I don't know what the hell they've been doing. But Eros is what they decided on. And everyone knows what happened on Eros. The other side did it. No research and recovery ships because they're all fighting each other or guarding something. The war? It's a distraction. And Protogen is doing what? Seeing what their toy does when you take it out for a spin is my guess, Miller said. They were silent for a long moment. Holden spoke first. So, you take a company that seems to be lacking in institutional conscience, that has enough government research contracts to almost be a privately run branch of the military, how far will they go for the Holy Grail? First, fastest, furthest, Miller replied. Yeah. Guys, Naomi said, you should come down here. I think I've got something.